chapter in these oracles that began with symbolic actions in chapter 4 and continued through 5 and 6 and come now to a kind of conclusion in chapter 7. And as you can sense already from the reading of it, the seventh chapter is really not adding any new revelation data, but is rather deepening the impression that it makes upon us. You might say that it's a kind of restatement in final form, in the highest intensity, of the central thought that we've already seen, which is that the end of the Old Testament theocracy is now upon the Old Covenant people. Now please notice the divisions of this chapter, which I think can be made as follows. First of all, you have a summary statement in verses 2 to 4 in which the central idea is restated. Son of man, this is what the sovereign Lord says to the land of Israel. The end has come upon the four corners of the land. The end is now upon you, and so on. And it ends with that phrase in the end of verse 4, then, meaning when this comes to pass, then you will know that I am the Lord. And then, in the verses that follow from 5 to 27, you have a fourfold repetition of some of the details of this general idea stated in that opening section. And these are called in Hebrew prophetic literature strophes, verses 5 to 9, just as you have them in the NIV paragraph Bible, 10 to 14, 15 to 22, and 23 to the end. Now it seems to me that one of the main emphases in this chapter which stands out is the time reference, because in verse 2, in verse 3, in verse 6 and 7, in verse 10 and 12, you have this heavy emphasis upon the time. Verse 2, the end has come. Verse 3, the end is now upon you. Verse 6, the end has come, the end has come. And in Hebrew writing, saying a thing twice is how you make it loud and clear. You're really supposed to take note. And then it has roused itself against you, verse 6. It has come. Doom has come upon you. You who dwell in the land, the time has come. The day is near. And then verse 10, the day is here. It has come. Verse 12, the time has come. The day has arrived. I ask you, would it be possible to say more clearly that the time has come, that the hour is arrived? Which means that whatever this section is dealing with, it's not something far off in the future, but it is something right now starting to unfold. That, I think, is the very least that we can say about it. Another thing that is repeated three times is that phrase, then you will know that I am the Lord. You see it at the end of verse 4. You see it at the end of verse 9. And then again at the end of the chapter. Three times it is stated, Then you will know that I am Jehovah, or that it is I, Jehovah, who strikes the blow. And the fact that a thing is said three times in the Bible is always a way of giving it great prominence. So we could say the ultimate end that God has in doing this to Israel is that they might know that He is God. They haven't been recognizing Him as God, which is what they should have been doing, but God will bring it about that they will recognize Him anyway. Now note some of the special circumstances in this tolling of the bell of doom. Verse 4, no pity this time. I will not look on you with pity or spare you. I surely will repay you for your conduct and the detestable practices among you. Now you all know that in previous history of God's old covenant people, that never was true. True, He did send chastisements upon them, like, for example, the 40 years in the wilderness. But it was never an all-out, completely unleashed expression of God's wrath as it is this time. Verse 5 says there will be an unheard of disaster. And I believe that that unheard of disaster cannot but be associated with what we read in chapter 5, verse 9. Look at that again, if you will. We already zeroed in on that once before, but the statement there was, because of all of your detestable idols, I will do to you what I never have done before and will never do again. Well, when he says there in verse 9, I will not look on you with pity or spare you, he is really telling us what that unheard of disaster is. This will be a full unleashing of the wrath of God in an unparalleled manner. And I believe that this began with the Babylonian captivity and came to its ultimate expression in the complete destruction of all that was left of the theocracy in 70 AD in Rome under the armies of Titus. And you remember that we tied this in last time with Matthew chapter 24, where virtually that same statement is repeated. I believe that this clearly links with those two things that we've already looked at. And I might add that the ramifications of that judgment, which began at Babylon, culminated in the destruction of the temple and the complete removal of God's old covenant people from the land of Palestine. I believe the ramifications of that judgment continue to this very day in the blindness of Israel and the many sorrows that they have experienced for 2,000 years. One must tremble at the thought of the severity of God's judgment. We also looked at that last time. But verse 8 says that this judgment is reasonable. To us, such wrath may seem unreasonable, but it is not unreasonable in the light of what has been done. I am about to pour out my wrath on you and spend my anger. Spend means let it all out. I will judge you according to your conduct and repay you for all your detestable practices. In other words, when you take into account the way the Israelites preferred idolatry to the true and living God, not once or twice, but many times over, provoking the wrath of God again and again and again, then this does not seem unreasonable. Verse 10, I believe, clearly establishes that the Babylonian captivity is the beginning of the end of the theocracy of Israel, because you have words and phrases expressing beginning. The day is here, it has come. Doom has burst forth, the rod has budded. That means it's in its early stages. The arrogance has blossomed. Not the harvest time yet, but it's beginning. Violence has grown up into a rod to punish wickedness, and so on. Now, I believe that that means that the beginning of this process of the terrible judgment of God against His old covenant people has begun, and I believe it also shows that the root of it is the violence that has been perpetrated by God's covenant people. Some commentators take the word violence there to be a reference to the Babylonians, the idea being that they were a violent people, they were militaristic, and they have been growing in power. Well, they've now reached the place where they can be used as a rod to punish wickedness. But John Calvin, the great reformer, in his commentary, argues for the application of that to the people of God themselves. It's the fact that they have grown violent that is really the root of the matter. In any event, whichever of the two you choose, they are related. It was clearly the wickedness, the apostasy, and the sinful violence of the people of God which brought it about that the sovereign God raised up this rod with which to punish them, and that rod was, of course, without a question, the Babylonian power. So these two interpretations do not amount to a significant difference anyway. Now in verses 11 and 12, you see that the calamity will be such that rich and poor will be equal. It really has to be drastic calamity for that to be true. In most situations of war and famine or whatever happens to come, people with a lot of wealth manage to escape to a greater extent than people without any wealth. It's the poorest that get hit the hardest, but not when it's a complete and total wipeout, as we might call it, as took place with the nation of Israel. We have seen a good modern illustration of what this means in the Nazi program of liquidating the Jews in Europe. When that terrible thing came, it didn't help at all to have money. They just took it, and you were in exactly the same boat as somebody that didn't have money. You could have been a rich doctor, lawyer, or banker yesterday, and today you're not one bit better off than the poor scrub woman because your money doesn't work anymore to your advantage. In verse 13, you see that one of the consequences of this all-out expression of God's wrath against Israel is the loss of Jubilee blessings. You may remember that in the Old Testament law of Moses, you had the Jubilee law. Every 50th year, even if you had suffered great financial loss and you had lost the land of your family inheritance and had gone into servitude to your debt, to those to whom you were in debt, yet on the 50th year, the year of Jubilee, whoever it is that had your land had to give it back to you. And you started from square one all over again. That was one of the marvelous provisions of the law of Moses, the year of Jubilee, when inequities and inequalities were put right again, and God showed in this way his grace to his covenant people in blessing them in a way no other people was blessed. But here, this is not going to work anymore. Verse 13, the seller will not recover the land he has sold as long as both of them live, for the vision concerning the whole crowd will not be reversed. Because of their sins, not one of them will preserve his life. They're going into captivity. They are going to be slaves of the Romans. They're not even going to live under Mosaic laws of a political kind anymore. They won't be a theocracy anymore. And so any hopes of Jubilee blessings are gone and gone for good. And there isn't a thing they can do about it, verse 14. They can try to take countermeasures to defeat God's decree, but it is not going to work. Though they blow the trumpet and get everything ready, no one will go into battle, because my wrath is upon the whole crowd. So there is no way that they can take any effective countermeasures to what God has decreed. And the reason is stated in verses 15 through 19. The reason is that God is going to bring upon them a multiform catastrophe. The sword outside, plague and famine inside. And it does seem to me that here in this section, the prophet is focusing particularly on what we know to have come to pass in its most aggravated form at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem. Outside the city walls were the armies of Rome. Inside was exactly plague and famine. The great history of Josephus just makes that live for you. And the people that were out in the country died by the sword, and those who were in the city were devoured either by famine or plague. And even the few who survived were indeed like moaning doves of the valley. And everyone was affected so much that they lost heart, every knee was weak, every hand was limp, and so on. You all have heard of the defense of Masada, that high, flat-top mountain with sheer cliffs where a band of Israelites fortified themselves to make an all-out stand against the Romans, but they didn't escape either. And to this day, from an airplane, you can see this great mound of earth that the Romans just piled up so they could walk up there and go into Masada. And when they came, every last person, maybe one or two, that hid under the floor escaped, but all the rest had committed suicide rather than face the Romans. But they didn't escape, you see. Well, it's that kind of thing that we read about here in these verses. So universal will be the effect that everyone will experience it. That's stated in verses 17 and 18. And in verse 19, nobody will be able to buy their way out of it. Gold and silver won't mean anything. If you had a loaf of bread in the city of Jerusalem, you could get all the gold in the city. That's the kind of situation it was. The rich man couldn't get anything anymore. And verse 20 and following shows us the elements of divine retribution in this. Since their gold was the thing they had used idolatrously to ornament their gods, their false gods, God will therefore see to it that this is utterly useless to them and will become a spoil for their captors. And you see, again, the intensity of the wrath of God in verses 21 and 22. I will hand it all over as plunder to foreigners. I will turn my face away from them. And if God turns his face away, that means he doesn't care, he doesn't look. He is not going to see anyone pleading for mercy. He's just turned away and let the Babylonians and later on the Romans do as they would. Now, verse 23 probably refers to another symbolic act. Prepare chains, because the land is full of bloodshed, and the city is full of violence. I will bring the most wicked of the nations to take possession of their houses. I will put an end to the pride of the mighty, and their sanctuaries will be desecrated. Probably he was to, in some way, symbolically display chains as a final warning of what's going to happen. They're going to be led away in chains. And when that terror comes, as verse 25 says, they can seek peace, but there won't be any. And the calamity will come. And please don't overlook the ultimate point, the ultimate fact in God's wrath against them. They will try to get a vision from the prophet. The teaching of the law by the priest will be lost, as will the counsel of the elders. As you might take note of in, I think it's Hosea, is it not? 6 verse 6. I thought I'd written that down. Well, in any event, the reference I'm looking for is, it's Amos 8:11. There it is. In Amos 8:11, you see another statement of this in an unforgettable form. The days are coming, declares the Sovereign Lord, when I will send a famine through the land. Not a famine of food or a thirst for water, but a famine of hearing the words of the Lord. Men will stagger from sea to sea and wander from north to south to east, searching for the word of the Lord, but they will not find it. Now that's really what is being stated here. They will try to get a vision, but to no avail. In other words, the final and ultimate mark of God abandoning a people is that he takes that away from them. And vision, of course, in that day meant a real and genuine revelation from God to his old covenant people through the prophet. And frankly, if I was a Jew and read that and didn't want to close my eyes to it, I would say, why is it that we have never had any more prophets? Well, they have, of course, but they didn't acknowledge them. They haven't acknowledged Jesus Christ, and so they've lived with an unfinished canon for thousands of years. Well, 2,000. And so you see the tremendous force of that statement. So the conclusion is restated, I will deal with them according to their conduct, and by their own standards I will judge them. Then they will know that I am the Lord. And it seems to me that that means they rejected God completely, he rejects them completely. They provoked him for centuries on end, he rejects them for centuries on end. But still, the ultimate aim is that they will know that he is the Lord. And I think that gives us a basis to continue to pray for the conversion of Israel. Now, what are some of the principles we learn from this chapter of the Bible? Number one, God's spokesmen must cry aloud and spare not when things are like they were in Ezekiel's day. You don't have any choice about that. Number two, clearly the great judgment, the great wrath expression of God against Israel had begun. And the tragedy was they still couldn't see it. And that's exactly why it had to come. Look at verse 4b. I will surely repay you, then you will know. It's not until after they are repaid that they will know. Clearly implies that there's something wrong with them at the present time. Since it's only way off in the future that they'll know, then that clearly shows that at the present time they don't know. That then shows that it was their blindness that demanded their judgment. Number three, to whom much is given, much is required. Either in a life of thankfulness and devotion to the Lord, or divine judgment by the Lord. In the first several thousand years of the world's history, to no one were the blessings given as to Israel. Rightly then did God expect and require much of them, and they repaid him with the preference for idolatry, and so his just judgment. We are reminded here of Proverbs 29, verse 1. It applies to an individual, but also to a nation and to a church. A man who remains stiff-necked after many rebukes will suddenly be destroyed and without remedy. God is loving, God is patient, God is long-suffering, God is gracious, God is delights in forgiveness, but there is a limit to his patience. A fifth principle is this: apostasy is a corporate phenomenon. The church as a whole was apostate. That doesn't mean that every individual in Israel was an unbeliever. That never is true. But the church as a whole, Israel as God's covenant people, as a body, was apostate. And consequently, the whole suffered. I remember some years ago a very perceptive remark by Professor John Murray at Westminster. He said, if you wonder sometimes why spiritual life is even as weak as it is in Orthodox churches, he was thinking of the OPC, then don't forget that it is because the church as a whole, the totality of the Christian church on earth today, is in a very distressed state. Its unfaithfulness is so obvious and so dreadful. And this has an effect on every part of the church. We don't escape it entirely. Number six, the surest proof of the divine wrath is the withdrawal of the Word. If you want to know when God has given a people up, look at that and you'll know. If they no longer have His Word amongst them, God's real, true, genuine Word, then you know that they have suffered the most dreadful chastisement of all, the most dreadful judgment. Far better to have a bad year of crops than to lose that, and so on. You could illustrate that. Principle number seven, the ultimate purpose of God in judgment and wrath is to compel the wicked to acknowledge that He is Jehovah. Now, He wants us to do this willingly as a response to His grace, but if we don't, He will compel us to do it in response to His wrath. But He will bring us to know that He is the Lord. Another principle that is important is this. In an evil day, what is needed is to be able to see reality. God enabled Ezekiel to see it in his day, and the Bible says, there has not arisen a greater amongst them born of women than John the Baptist. Christ said that. So even Ezekiel wasn't greater than John the Baptist. And then he said, but he who is least in the kingdom of God is greater than John the Baptist. Now, he didn't mean a greater being, because we're both human. He didn't mean that people now are going to be given a greater reward than Daniel, but what he meant was that we stand in a higher, more privileged position than John the Baptist or Ezekiel. And what that adds up to is this. Any one of us who really will take heed to the Bible, we can see. If you don't want to take heed to the Bible, you can't see. But if you will take heed to the Bible, you can see today. Even though thousands are blind, you can see. And this principle, finally, when such dark days come upon the church of God, yet remember, He is working out His perfect purpose. And even the evil day redounds to His glory. And never was that more true than in the wonderful work of the prophet Ezekiel. Even in such dark days, there is a great work for God's faithful to be doing. And we must always realize, too, that the ultimate fruit of the labor of the Lord's people may be a long ways from where they are when they do it. In other words, the work of Ezekiel didn't bear fruit in his day, but it bore a tremendous fruit far down the road from his day, in the time when the New Testament church began and people understood, Christian people and the nucleus of
the true Israel understood these things. Any questions from any of you about this chapter? Anything in it that bothered you or had questions about?